Hello, everybody. We are back for another episode of the Hauenstein Center's podcast, Off the Stage. I am your host, Maddie Miller. I'm the media specialist for the Hauenstein Center. And tonight, we have a really special event that we are screening, a documentary, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce because I know that I'm not going to pronounce it correctly. So, Nate, I'm going to have you pronounce it. What is the title of your documentary?
The title is French.
Yes.
It is Pour le Peuple.
Peuple.
I am not an expert French accented speaker myself, but it's pour le peuple, which is for the people.
Yes, French. I love it. I have definitely been calling it pour le people, and I'm like, I know
that
that's
would not be it.
Yeah, I know that's wrong, which is why I'm like, I'm not even going to attempt it. But we are so excited to be screening that documentary tonight, which is about a Grand Rapids sculpture, La Grande Vitesse, which was created by Alexander Calder. And today on the podcast, our podcast guest is the writer, producer, and director of the documentary, Nate Harrison. Nate, thanks for flying to Grand Rapids.
Thank you to you all for having me out.
We are so excited to show this film, and we are excited. We have had so many people call our office and just be like, I'm so excited about this film.
Oh, I love this stuff
and be excited to RSVP. So
getting a warm little fuzzy right now.
We know we're putting on a great event when we have that. And this event, I also need to say, is a Hauenstein Center Common Ground Initiative event in partnership with GVSU Art Gallery, which have been great partners for us for this event and bringing this film here. So we are going to start our podcast today with what we always start our podcast with, which is the famous BOQ, stands for Bowl of Questions.
I see the BOQ in front of me here.
You have right in front of you. Take one in there and read it out loud, and then you get to answer the question, which is the most exciting part.
Here we go. Are you reading any good books / binging any good shows right now? I just started actually a book, and I'm going to apologize for, I'm not sure I'm going to say the exact title, but it is a art theory book that my PhD advisor wrote, recently published. It just came out within like the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. The book is called something like Artistic Sovereignty, Aesthetic Autonomy from the Enlightenment to the Avant-Garde. Or something like that.
Okay.
It is by Grant Kester, who is an art historian at the University of California, San Diego.
Okay.
He was my PhD advisor at UC San Diego.
Love that.
One of the smartest people I've ever met. And he's published several books, but this is his latest one. I haven't exactly kept up with his writing in a while, so it's good to see his new book come out. And it is all about the question of autonomy in art.
Okay.
We can certainly go into that if you really want to nerd out.
I feel like I'm not going to be able to follow along with the conversation. That's so cool to read a book that by somebody you know and really respect, like personally. I feel like that's
awesome. I know Grant very well.
Yeah.
And, I did for many years. And when I do read it, I do hear his voice.
I love that.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Any TV shows worthy of mention?
Given the sort of the turmoil in the Middle East, I stumbled upon a show on Netflix. Maybe your audience knows it, or you even know it, Maddie. What is the title? It's like Riot in Arabic. I think it's like Faoud or something like that. I mispronounced that, but it is kind of a crime drama, or it's essentially kind of like the sort of the secret agents of the Israeli whatever kind of trying to infiltrate Hamas and Hamas infiltrating them. And I don't know how accurate it is, but it is.
It's not a documentary. It's purely drama.
It's fiction. It's a drama. A drama. And it's all in subtitles. It's all in Hebrew and Arabic.
I
just started watching it last week and I've seen like 3 or 4 episodes.
Yeah. Okay. Love it. And would you recommend?
I have my own sort of political beliefs about that whole situation,
which we'll save
for another time. But so I can't attest to like the kind of accuracy of it, but it is a good drama in terms of like it's suspenseful and it kind of makes you like bite your nails at certain points and like, you know, in suspense and whatnot. So
love it. Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Let's do one more BOQ question.
Sure.
I always like these. Questions written by some from social media people submit, and then some are student workers, right? So,
What 3 things would you bring onto a desert island?
Wow, this is like your classic get to know you question, I feel like. I love it.
I would bring, this is actually really easy for me.
Okay, love it.
Just because I can think of three things very quickly, but it might be different next week. Who knows?
Yeah.
I would bring my daughter.
Okay, love that.
I have
entertainment, or do you think resourcefulness?
Well, she and I are very close.
Yeah.
And her mother sadly passed away in 2019. Mm. And so we just, you know, we kind of been this dynamic duo ever for since then. And so I just don't live my life without her next to me.
Yeah.
And vice versa. So love it that. Just, I can't imagine her not being part of my life.
Yeah. I love it. What's her name?
Natalia.
Natalia. Love it. Okay. Yeah.
You'll meet her tonight.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
She's in the film.
In the film. And
she's much younger in the film than she is now. Yes. Now she's 9 going on 19.
Yeah, as they always do. She uses
slang terms that I don't know. And
I love it.
And she's, the other day she said something like, Dad, that's so 80s. She was born in 2014.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like.
So what does 80s mean?
Yeah, I was like, what does that even mean to
How
you?
How does she know?
What does you even, what is what?
That's funny.
So the other two things are I would bring my camera.
Okay.
I have a fancy camera. The camera that I'm currently using, I did not use to shoot the film.
Okay.
I used a different camera for the film.
Yeah.
The camera I have now is actually even nicer than the one I used to shoot the film.
Wow.
But I love it. I love being a camera geek and just nerding out on cameras. And so I definitely would have to bring that. And the third thing would be music.
Okay.
Absolutely have to have music.
Great. Well, I'm already like, I feel like those three things are a perfect combo for like you're shooting some show. I don't know, on a desert island. Like, that's the perfect combo.
Yes.
I love this.
Exactly.
I'm excited for this to drop soon.
We'll see.
Love it. Well, thank you for answering our wonderful BOQ questions. And now on to the questions that I have curated, just from my own general curiosity and also I did a little bit of research on you. So,
oh, boy. Okay.
But I always like to just start at the beginning. Tell us about your childhood background. Where did you grow up? What did you do for fun growing up? What were you interested in?
I grew up here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I grew up on the southeast side of town.
Okay.
I would have gone to Ottawa Hills High School, but for the fact that I went to City High School, which I believe still exists.
Yeah.
So I actually went to school, like in high school, at that time City High School was downtown. It was just within walking distance of the Calder. So I saw the Calder all the time. It was just kind of my natural, part of my natural environment. I grew up here. What I like to do, I love to play football, ride bikes, collect comic books. I'll admit that I had a collection of like toy guns when I was 10 years older.
We'd play
cops and robbers or whatever, army or whatever it is with my friends after school. I did not wear a helmet, as I think many people of my generation did not wear helmets, like riding our bikes or anything like that. And now, I don't know exactly how it works here, but in New York City, it's like kids can't essentially walk down the street without wearing like helmets. it's like so crazy helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
And I was just telling my daughter the other day, like when I was growing up, we got into fights and we would frequently come home from school with like bloody lips and like we played King of the Mountain and dodgeball and we get binged in the head, like it was just a crazy time. And yet here we are. Of a fun, if rough childhood and, typical Midwest.
Childhood. Yeah. I love it. That's cool. And then kind of moving on to your college career. So you decide to go to college. Tell us about your decision on which college to go to and what to major in.
Sure. So both of my parents are University of Michigan alumni.
Okay.
So it was sort of like a given that I was going to go to U of M. It was just not even a question.
Yeah.
So I did, in fact, go to U of M. Mm-hmm. I went to the art school at U of M.
Cool.
I majored in photography.
Yeah.
At that time, digital tools and whatnot really didn't exist. And what little they did were extremely high-end and esoteric. And we had I think we got some sort of like video mixer or something when I was a senior. But for the most part, my education was totally analog photography.
Yeah, yeah. And why did you decide to go into photography? Is that something you enjoyed in high school? Or
I actually was on the yearbook photography staff in high school. Yeah, I guess I kind of was already had a kind of an organic kind of interest in that. Mm-hmm. And I really liked special effects as a kid and just tinkering with cameras and lenses and stuff like that. So it just seemed like kind of a natural thing to do. So I went to U of M for photography, got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in photography.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good experience.
Yeah, that's awesome. I have to ask too, are you still a U of M fan?
I am. I'm okay. Very much, I am not a sports fan generally speaking. Okay. I don't really follow sports in the way that some die hard, you know, people can follow the Tigers or the Lions or you know, hockey or what have you.
Yeah.
But if there is a team that I do semi follow, it's the Wolverines. I mean, it's Michigan. I mean, it's like the most classic football, college football. There is, period.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm actually on the opposite end. I grew up an Ohio State fan.
Oh, no, so no.
I have to say it. We got a big game coming up in a couple of weeks. So that's my favorite thing as a Michigander to say. It's
super fun. Super fun. I was actually telling my girlfriend a little while back that she has to go to a football game in the Big House.
Yeah. There's heard that stadium is incredible.
It's like 112,000 people or something like that. It's crazy.
That's awesome. And then I saw on your profile, you have two other degrees too. So tell us a little bit about those. Where did you go? Why did you decide to get those, et cetera?
Yeah, so I graduated from Michigan. I went through Michigan. Again, it was a very analog pre kind of internet world. So email was just coming out just as I was leaving school. So okay. I think there was, every student was given like an email account and access to that in my senior year. But I never once sent an email. I thought I didn't really understand it. So I didn't send any emails. The internet started right at that moment. My brother and I kind of figured out, he was in the School of Engineering at U of M. And so he
at the same time as you? Or?
He was a little bit younger, but he was kind of there just as I was leaving, but I was still living in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
So he and I lived together for a while. Awesome. So he kind of knew or figured out like the back end code type stuff, which is essentially HTML, very primitive to like what we do now.
For sure.
Well, I kind of knew how to do like the front end graphic designing and the visual stuff. So the two of us just started building websites. And then for a while, we actually had a company going where we were building websites for local, like West Michigan, and actually East Michigan companies. And that was really cool. And then with those skills, I had several of my friends moving to New York City, and it was like kind of a running joke because we all knew that like we were going to be like kind of poor artists, and all of a sudden all my friends were in like New York City making like $50,000 or $60,000 a year to do like web design, which in 1994, 1995, whatever, was like, that's not bad.
Yeah.
You know? So they coaxed me into moving to New York City.
Okay.
Moved to New York City. I worked in the sort of the commercial creative industries generally, in many capacities, up until about 2002, I kind of got sick of it. I felt like I needed something new in my life. I decided to go to grad school.
Okay.
And I went to California Institute of the Arts out in Los Angeles, or CalArts for short.
Yeah. And you moved there?
I moved to Los Angeles.
Wow, that's...
from New York City.
I was going to say, what a difference.
Yeah. Both and coasts. Extremely different.
Yeah.
Very, very different. And I had lived in New York City about six-ish years by that point, and I moved to Los Angeles, and I lived there for about six-ish years.
Okay.
Did CalArts, and I actually had a life-changing experience at CalArts. It was amazing.
Wow.
Loved it so much so that I when I was, you know, I graduated, I was like, I'm not done with school.
Yeah.
And so I went and I did a PhD program.
Okay, so immediately after your master's.
A year later. I graduated in 2005. Yeah, I guess so. I graduated in 2005 and then in the fall of 2006, so about a year in between, I started at UC San Diego.
Cool. That's awesome. And did you choose the San Diego school like based off of, like how'd you choose that school specifically for your doctorate?
That's a really great question. Number one is it has one of the few art programs, it was an art program, where the MFA, the master's students in studio art are housed within the same kind of space, literally, as the PhD students doing art history.
Okay.
So it's called the Department of Art there. And oftentimes in universities, those two things are in separate parts of the campus entirely. It's like the studio art where they make stuff is over here.
Yeah.
Way over somewhere else is like the art historians who are writing, you know,
book chapters and papers and whatnot.
And it's UC San Diego. Those two things were the same, under the same roof.
That's awesome.
Which excited me because I had an MFA.
Yeah.
And I want to do a PhD, which is maybe a little less common, less rare now. But at that time, it was kind of rare. And so I just kind of felt like I had feet in both worlds, academic and kind of studio/artistic.
Yeah.
So I just felt it was a really natural space. Plus, I already was familiar with Southern California. Mm-hmm. It's much cheaper to go to a UC state, you know, state school as a California resident.
Okay, yeah.
Like an out-of-state.
Yeah, so. For sure, than state tuition.
And then finally, I think I mentioned my PhD advisor before.
Yeah, yeah.
He was there, and I knew who he was already, and so I was excited about working with him. So it just seemed like a good... And I don't know if you've ever been to La Jolla, but it's also like gorgeous weather. And
I have. So my cousins actually used to live in San Diego. Oh, so okay. We've been there a few times to visit them. So yeah. It is a beautiful, beautiful city. Yeah. So love it. Love to hear it. Talking a little bit about the documentary, kind of moving. I know I don't want to spoil any questions that people might ask tonight because mm-hmm. we're going to have a cool Q&A part, but just for the podcast, just wanted to learn first kind of what your reasoning for making this documentary was about. Obviously, someone who lives in New York making a documentary about a Grand Rapids thing. I know you grew up here and stuff, so tell us just a little bit about kind of getting that idea and actually pushing start on the process.
Yeah. So this is actually a really strange but kind of cool story. My primary kind of intellectual and artistic interests while doing my grad degrees had to do with the sort of the intersection of artistic production, cultural production, generally speaking, new media, electronic media, mm-hmm. But not necessarily that stuff. You know, just kind of the art production, I would say, or cultural production generally, and intellectual property law.
Yeah.
And so I had already written a lot and talked, written about music and sampling, and I had written a lot about appropriation, visual art, appropriation art in the visual arts with the postmodernism and the pictures generation and all of that stuff. And so I just had a sort of a general, I follow a lot of copyright lawyers and art lawyers, and just kind of generally aware of the conversation, with the so-called art law conversation is what we kind of generally refer to it as.
Yeah.
And around, I want to say, 2011 or 12, I just got a phone call from the Calder Foundation in New York City. And they said, hey, we have this, exhibition space at our foundation here in the city. And we occasionally invite artists to come respond to Calder's work, in the space, establish some sort of visual, or dialogue or something.
Okay.
With the work. Would you mind if we come over and visit you and do a studio visit and we talk about maybe you doing a project in the space? And I said, okay, that'd be great. That's cool.
That's
so
awesome.
These two curators came over, mm-hmm. and as a kind of a way to break the ice, they just said, hey, we're the curators and just get started. Are you familiar with Alexander Calder's work? And I said, well, that's funny that you should ask, because actually I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where there's La Grande Vitesse, which is, one of his more well-known sculptures. Mm-hmm. Soon as I said that, they said, this is kind of a touchy subject because we don't really like to talk about that sculpture that much, because that's the one Calder sculpture that the foundation has no control over. We don't have the intellectual property rights to that sculpture.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, I mean, I was literally writing a dissertation about art and intellectual property right in that moment. And so I said, tell me more.
Yeah.
So I got very interested kind of in that moment. And that kind of made me just start digging around and trying to understand more. I grew up with the Calder. We all know what it is, of course. It's downtown, it's on all the street signs, et cetera.
Sure.
We all know.
Yeah.
And yet now I was kind of starting to, I think anyway, kind of uncover another kind of angle of the story that I wondered how many people really knew. And so I just started kind of plotting it out. And then it was always also kind of on the back burner because I was working full time. I was raising a family.
Yeah.
And so then in 2019, I finally kind of got the opportunity to kick it into high gear. And I'm really glad I had waited up until that point, even though I didn't intend to, because I realized that was the 50th anniversary of the sculpture was in June of 2019.
Wow. Okay.
It had been installed in June of 1969.
Yeah.
And so that summer I realized oh crap, that I can't not be in Grand Rapids and film it for the 50th. So I cold called Nancy Malnix. And we had introduced myself. She immediately was wanted to talk. We hit it off. We had a great time. I'm still really close with her now. And so I just went to Grand Rapids and just shot a ton of stuff, not exactly even knowing what the sort of the narrative arc of the film would be, but just that I knew it had something to do with the ownership of the sculpture mm-hmm. and how Grand Rapidians think about the sculpture and the ways that that's changed over the years.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to sort of give the history lesson of it, but maybe give other angles that people might not necessarily have about before.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And also it was just so weird that I was like from there too. It was a topic that was sort of interesting to me about, you know, intellectual property and art, but also mm-hmm. what a cool thing that it's, the example is like in my hometown.
Yeah.
So I felt
and you
like
were in your hometown when you kind of found
yeah.
this story.
So it gave me this opportunity to come back, but also kind of reintroduce myself in a mm-hmm. sense to the city after having not been around for a while
yeah.
and meet people that I had known a long time ago, but also meet entirely new people and see how much the city has changed over the years. And so that's how it started.
That is so cool to hear. And this is like making me so excited to watch the film
oh,
tonight.
Cool.
Were there any major roadblocks that you came to while you were in the process of making this film? Any big problems?
I will
I
say there was no big ones.
Okay.
Everybody I met in Grand Rapids that helped me, and I did have a couple people. There was one instance where my wife at the time was still alive, but she mm-hmm. was quite sick, and I just couldn't. I was supposed to. There was a moment. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a moment where they sandblasted this Calder down.
No, I'm a new Grand Rapidian.
Oh, okay. So
of
they
the last two
the
years.
The Calder
so.
Is this kind of reddish orange
yeah.
color, and
uh-huh.
but had not been, and it was like a few years ago. It was looking mm-hmm. kind of really
yeah.
it needed some TLC kind of
yeah.
thing. So a few years ago, they sandblasted it down. They completely removed all the paint on it.
Wow.
So it was gray.
Yeah.
And you'll see it in the film. So
yeah.
I was like, oh, I have to be there. I have to capture that. But
yeah.
I couldn't go because my wife at the time was uh-huh. sick. And so, you know, I had I just reached out to some people, and they, you know, they steered me towards some other people, some video people here in Grand Rapids. And so they shot it for me.
Yeah.
Super nice. So
that
in general,
so
I would
nice.
Say
yeah.
that everybody's been really, really, everybody was really helpful in helping me, you know, work on this. But I will mm-hmm. say I made the mistake of, because that weekend mm-hmm. of June 2019, which was the 50th anniversary, they're having all sorts of celebrations around the Calder, but that those celebrations happened during festival.
Okay. Yes.
Right, during the arts festival.
Yeah.
Right, that weekend.
Yes.
So I made the mistake of contacting the festival organizers and saying,
yeah,
I'm shooting a documentary. I'd love to just like shoot some stuff around festival. Uh-huh. I'm literally like one guy
yeah.
with like a camera. I'm
yeah.
not some big production crew.
Oh, and they
and I think
that
they were imagining that I was like some big production crew that's going to
yeah.
have like trailers with
yeah.
like a bagel, you know, bagels outside for the actors and like all this stuff with like, you know, electric cables across the street that they've got to shut down traffic
yeah,
and blah,
yeah,
blah, blah,
yeah.
blah. So they were like, okay, well, you need to pay this, you know, you need to have a fee. You know, and I was like, I don't have the money to pay. Like, I'm just a dude with a
yeah.
camera. Like, I'm like any schmo with
yeah.
a camera.
Yeah.
So I kind of went down the road of like, it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Ah.
So
yes.
once.
Did that fare well?
Well, there
you?
Was one moment. I got to say, there was one moment where I was shooting around festival and the lead guy that I'd been talking to saw me. And he was like, no, we got to talk. But he saw me kind of at a distance.
Yeah, and then did
and
you
just I just kind of was like, okay, I'll be right back. I got to go. And I just kind of, like, avoided him and kept
yeah.
shooting.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And, yeah, so.
Yeah, and did you ever need to give forgiveness or, hey?
I never followed up. I never yeah. heard anything, you know.
Hey, then you're all good, I think.
I mean, I'm sorry. I was just walking around the street
yeah.
photographing. You know,
exactly.
as anybody would with their iPhone or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so
for
I mean,
sure.
I had a fancier camera than an iPhone, but still, it wasn't
yeah.
like nobody would have thought that I was like some film crew.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and you'll see that when you see the film. It's
yeah.
like, that's obvious.
I love it. That's so cool. My last question, kind of about the film, is what's next for it? I know that it's not available to the public right now, so we're screening it tonight, which is so exciting. But some people listening to this podcast may not have access to watching it and whatnot. Will they ever have access to it, or what do you have kind of in the works for the finished product?
Yes, they will. At least one GVSU student emailed me and said he's supposed to write like a paper for his class, and
okay.
one of the options was like writing a paper about the film, and
uh-huh.
he said, but I can't see it tonight because I have another commitment, or
yeah.
for whatever reason he can't come tonight.
Yeah.
And could he watch it online?
Yeah.
Or later. And I said, you know what? Tell you what, I will send you like the password protected link or whatever
okay. yeah.
after tonight.
Okay.
I do, you know, I because a lot of my thinking and again my interests are around intellectual property, always been kind of in the camp of, you know, let information be free, and all the things you can see on my website are essentially like free to watch and whatever. The only reason mm-hmm. why I don't let people watch the current film about Calder mm-hmm. is because I'd been submitting it to film festivals for and whatnot. Sure. And they have, you know, kind of more strict rules about they don't want it available because they want to kind of, you know,
cultivate
this rare,
for sure,
you know, screening kind of thing. So I've been in a few festivals at this point. I have a few that are still, they're still, you know, deciding. But I definitely, you know, have the intention of making it just generally public on my website with no password or anything in the next few months. That's kind of my plan.
Love it.
And if anybody really wants to see it, it says on my website, you know, you can contact me. So it's not really like I'm trying to withhold it as much as I just want to let this kind of film festival cycle happen first.
Of course. Awesome. Well, when that becomes available, you know, public or whatever, please let us know. We would love
to
promote that.
I will do.
To our audience. Kind of moving on from the film and more just about you, when you think over your career, I'm sure you've done a lot of cool things. What is one accomplishment that you're really proud of? And you can't say this documentary, even though I'm sure you are really proud.
One of the projects that kind of blew up, and this was many years ago now, this was in like 2005-ish, somewhere around there, I made a work about a music sample. That it's on my website. Anybody can check this out. But there was a song released in coincidentally also 1969.
Okay.
Released in 1969 called Amen Brother, by a band called like a soul kind of gospel and R&B band called the Winstons. Mm-hmm. And there's a drum solo in the middle of that song that, you know, it's just drums playing. There's no other guitars or vocals or anything like that. And that 6 seconds. That drums have been sampled by other like hip hop musicians and like electronic musicians in the UK and like drum and bass and like all of this stuff thousands and thousands of times to make entirely other like whole worlds and genres of music. And so this is one of my first projects having to do with like cultural production and intellectual property law. And I made this kind of audio essay similar in a sense to what I'm showing tonight, but it was one of my first projects. It's not as long. It's about, I want to say like 17 or 18 minutes long or something like that. And it's just me telling this history of this Amen Break, but also its relationship to the United States copyright law and all this stuff. And it kind of blew up. It somehow got onto the internet and it became kind of viral. Oh. And I guess and it's even now, there's a YouTube video of it and it's got like 6+ million views.
That's so cool.
It's kind of cool. And but the part that I'm really proud of is that part of the story is that the creators of the drum sample didn't really get much compensation for it.
Yeah.
Like they didn't get much. And there's a whole kind of race aspect to it, which because of course the members of the band, it's actually really interesting because the Winstons were one of the few biracial bands. I think there were two white members and two black members and they had difficulty from what I understand booking shows because people were always there were straight up kind of, you know, racist people who wouldn't, book like, African American musicians, but also too, just, and it's just an unusual configuration.
Yes, for
and
sure.
So the short story is that they weren't, Richard Spencer, who was the copyright holder of this song, never really saw much money. And G.C. Coleman, by the way, was the drummer. They never really saw much money from all of the royalties or whatever that they could have possibly made from like people sampling them without permission, without compensation. And so I feel like the story I made, because it went viral, years later, there ended up being some DJs, I think in the UK, that started like a GoFundMe or Kickstarter campaign to raise money for Richard Spencer,
by
that point was, I think, the only living member of the band. And, you know, they didn't make millions for him, but they made like $30K.
At least be able to recognize.
And they gave that to him. They gave him a check for $30K.
That's awesome.
And so I'd like to believe anyway that like my project in some small way kind of helped just gain general awareness of like who he was, what the Winstons were, what this drum sample is.
Yeah.
And these DJs who were like, oh my God, so much of our culture would not have been possible without him in that original drum break.
Yeah.
And they raised $30,000 from him. And there's a whole thing online about him receiving it and being happy and, oh my gosh, this is so nice. And he just passed away a few years ago, or I want to say 2-ish years ago or something like that.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear how your work contributed.
I'd like to think that, I think it's really difficult to measure, but I do think that art can change the world. I mean, it sounds a little corny, but I actually do really believe that. And I like those instances where it's like you can see that, like, using aesthetics, using art to kind of tell stories and shed light on things that would not otherwise have been known can make the make a difference in the world.
For sure. I love that. I took a class in college. I was a communications major, and I took one class called Art and Aesthetics, and I learned so much in that class about that exact idea of just, like, the importance of art and what we call art and what is aesthetic and, you know, all those things. And, you know, there was no, like, found answer, and this is kind of just individually what did we think about these ideas. And it was so cool. So I love hearing that kind of stuff. I have two more questions for you.
Sure.
Second to last question is more about your life outside of work. So you've already talked about your dynamic duo of you and your daughter. Tell us a little about your family, about living in New York, and all of that.
Well, I have a partner also. She's great. She's amazing. Her name is Lourdes. She's really amazing. She, coincidentally, when I met her, it's funny, I met her actually as a play date because she also has a daughter.
Okay.
Who's the exact same age as my daughter.
Oh, I love that.
So they're like 3 or 4 months apart.
Wow.
And so they kind of like just bonded as like sisters, and they've kind of been tight ever since.
Yeah.
And both of them have individually, as you know, they were only children. They always, oh, I want a sibling.
Yeah.
Or something. And so that's just been really great to kind of like get to know Lourdes and her daughter and just us. We go snowboarding and skiing and,
awesome.
We go on, you know, vacations together. And that's been really great. So that's been kind of like healing since the turmoil of like my wife passing away. But then COVID happened and it was just like that, you know, 2019 to kind of 20 through 2021, maybe slightly into 2022 was really difficult set a few years,
for sure,
to be honest.
And those were the years that you were producing this documentary, right?
I shot about 75% of it in June of 2019 with the intention of starting to edit it then, and then kind of the, you know, the bleep hit the fan. And I had to kind of put the footage aside, but then during COVID I couldn't get to it right away because COVID was just, we all had to deal with it, and we had to go into emergency mode and whatnot. But eventually, maybe a year into COVID, I did get the chance to like now start thinking about writing the script for the documentary and looking through all the footage I had shot and realizing that there was still some things I was missing. But now I knew what was missing, and now I knew what I needed to go back to Grand Rapids for to shoot. I maybe came back here 2 or 3 times after the initial shooting just to pick up some other things, shoot some other things. But then I wrote it, and so, yeah, that did give me that kind of space to write it. So about me, other than that, I love to, you know, like I said, I like to, I'm a camera nerd, so I'm always filming stuff.
Yeah, love that.
Anybody who visits my Instagram will see it's just like corny videos of my daughter and my girlfriend's daughter and that. But with like a really fancy camera.
Yeah.
I love to run.
Okay, cool.
I'm an avid runner.
Yeah. Any races this year or next?
I ran this past year. I really only run half marathons.
That's so cool. I ran my first half marathon.
Good
this
for you.
Year.
Good
it
for you.
It was really hard.
I feel like the half marathon, I've run one full marathon. Okay. I've never run the New York City marathon, but I did run the Los Angeles marathon when I lived in LA.
Yeah.
Terrible experience.
Okay.
Terrible experience.
I've heard that from so many people about running a marathon.
I know some people that absolutely love it. Yeah. I would say this.
Okay.
I ran one marathon.
Yes.
I run about 4 to 5 half marathons every year.
Okay.
I really do think it's like the perfect distance. You're really tired at the end.
Yep. And it's
And it's hard, but you're not masochistic. You're not like hating life at the end.
Isn't it like you feel like it's kind of something you can do again and again?
Yes.
Where a marathon for the average person,
properly train for a marathon, you have to like plan bathroom routes when you're, you know, getting up in the training and you're going to like 16 plus miles or whatever. Like
for
you
sure.
have to like really dedicate a chunk of your life to properly training.
Yep.
You do have to train for halves, but if you get used to running them, like I said, I run maybe 4, sometimes 5 a year. Totally doable.
Yeah.
Totally doable.
I love that. That's cool.
So I just ran the Bronx 10 mile, which is not a half marathon, but it's 10 miles.
Yeah.
The Bronx 10 cool. mile. They have a like a 5 borough racing series in New York City.
Nice.
So it starts out with the New York City half marathon,
okay.
which is awesome. So yeah. I ran that. There is the Brooklyn half marathon, which I ran.
Cool.
Just recently ran the Staten Island half marathon.
Wow, okay.
That was a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And now the new season won't start until January, so there's no more half marathons until January.
Yeah, but hey, January half marathon, that's cold, right? I mean, is that...
You know what? I've run. There's one that they run in Central Park. It's called okay. the Fred LeBeau, who is the... Sorry, getting nerdy here, but he started the New York Roadrunners Club in New York City.
Okay.
There's a half marathon named after him. It's essentially 2.5 loops of Central Park.
Okay.
It's always in January. I've run it maybe like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
I've been lucky because it hasn't been that cold. It's been okay. like maybe in the 30s.
Okay.
Which if you are yeah. properly layered and whatnot, yeah, you're sure. fine. 5 minutes into the race, you're totally fine.
Yeah, yeah. I just joined a run club recently okay. because I'm... you know, kind of into running, and Tuesday morning was cold. That was our first one where I was, like, layered up. But as soon as you get running,
yeah,
then it's
you're
doable.
Fine. You're
you
kind of totally
just have
fine.
To start. You kind of just have to start.
Yeah, I think when it starts getting below 20 degrees yeah. is where I kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But anything above 20 is you can totally run, no problem.
For sure. I love that. Love to hear it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing. My last question is a question I always end the podcast with, and it's my favorite way to end it, is just basically if somebody listening wanted to kind of follow your career path, do things that you've done, accomplish what you've accomplished, what advice would you give them?
Oh my gosh, that is a tough one.
Putting you on the spot.
You know, I would just say a lot of focus, and I'll admit I've not always had the best focus. That's kind of come in waves in my career. But those moments where I was doing a lot and I felt, you know, like I was doing a lot, were those moments that I was really kind of focused. Mm-hmm. So I think focus is a really important thing. I read something. There was an author, I forget who it was, but there was an author that I follow who writes a lot about new media and new media theory, who I yeah. really respect. Extremely prolific writer. And I remember them saying something to the effect of, if you are about 75% done, if you think you're about 75% done with something, then you're done. Do not try to be a perfectionist.
Okay, yeah.
And because you'll never submit something think you're finished with it, because you're mm-hmm. always tinkering with it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I like that idea.
Yeah,
I like, and it's hard. I think it's hard for me to do anyway, and maybe other people. But it's, I always try to remember that better to like kind of keep doing stuff and going, trying to go forward rather than trying to make this some one thing perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice.
I didn't know. I don't know how useful this will be, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. After yeah. I did my bachelor's degree, I think that's probably not uncommon.
Oh, not at all.
So I spent 9 years in between my bachelor's degree and my master's degree just kind of yeah. working out in the world. And I would actually, I'm really happy I did that. Mm-hmm. Not sure I would have done it for nine years if given the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I do sometimes, you know, get students who are undergrads who come to me to ask for, you know, letters of recommendation and whatnot mm-hmm. for grad school.
Yeah.
And I say, don't go to grad school, like right after undergrad.
Yeah.
Wait a few years and kind of work in the world, see what the world is like really about,
mm-hmm.
get a sense of like what you love about post-school, what you hate about post-school,
yeah.
Learn about deadlines, budgets, yeah. like just like the realities of having to be sort of a responsible person in the world. And then if you still want to go to school,
yeah,
then go to school. And I would say that sort of in the context of art, you know, I'm in the kind of the art field. I just think that art made outside of the bubble of art school mm-hmm. will be much more interesting usually than art made within the bubble. So if you've only ever made, art within sort of the institutional frame of art making mm-hmm. and then you want to immediately go to grad school, it's like, I don't know, I just don't find that very interesting. So I would say
mm-hmm.
be in the world for also sure. is a, if you have long-term plans of going to school.
Yeah, I wish you could have been here to tell me that 2 years ago, because I did that, went to grad school right out of college, and then I quit my program because that's not what I wanted to do. And I'm here, 25, still have zero idea what I want to do.
I didn't go to grad. I didn't do my master's degree until I was 31.
Exactly.
So like maybe in the next year or something like that, you'll be like, I totally know what I want to go to school. And I found when I went to my grad school, I was just to touch upon what I said a second ago.
Yeah.
I was super focused.
Yeah.
I knew what I was doing. I knew. And when I got to school, I was surrounded by people who were maybe 5 to 7 years younger than me, who didn't know why. A lot of them, some of them were real amazing people, but some of them were still good people, but they didn't know what they were there for. They were just like, yeah, why not go to school?
That would have been, was that was like, me. Yeah.
And I just felt like I think you're going to spend a lot of, because CalArts is a private, you know, art school. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're going to leave the school with like a lot of debt, and I'm not sure you're getting the most out of this. I took advantage of every single opportunity when I was in grad school, because I just knew how sort of privileged the opportunity, what the privilege it offered me.
For sure. That's
so.
That's awesome. Yep.
But I also wouldn't beat yourself up if you know.
Yeah, well, I am proud of myself for quitting, because I feel like I would have just, you know, kept going, and then I had this random master's degree that I never maybe would have.
And I know plenty of people that have that. So.
Yeah, and I've learned so much more about myself and maybe like what direction I'm heading.
Yeah.
In this role, which is my first big girl job, I like to say, than I feel like I ever would have, you know, just doing a random master's program.
Yeah,
so
I feel like if you kind of want to commit to something, you're like, I'm really interested in this path. I think I know what I want to do now.
Yeah.
Then you just become so. My mother, she didn't get her master's. She got it at GVSU. Mm-hmm. She didn't do it until she was in her mid 40s.
Yeah,
she
I love
was
that.
Super dedicated and like. Yeah,
I love butt. That. That's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that advice, and thanks for sharing so much on this podcast.
Thank you.
Has been great. I can't wait for everyone to get to listen to it, and especially the people who are going to be at our event tonight. I'm sure they're going to want to learn more about you, because we're never going to have enough time for questions. So,
well, I really appreciate everybody's interest here, and it's just really humbling to be here.
For sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.